All right, thank you. May we be seated? Today, our first case is the people of the state of Colorado versus Derek Demetrius Wilson. Could I have the entry of appearance, please, for the petitioner?
Yes, Your Honor. Joseph Michael, attorney registration number 4043.
Thank you. And for the respondent, please.
Carolyn Blanchard, from Mr. Wilson. Registration number 3406.
Thank you. Today's case is set for 1 hour. That means that both sides have a half an hour. And that also means, Mr. Michaels, that you need to keep track of your time if you want to have any time left over for the vote. So you can go whenever you're ready, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. Chief Justice Rice, Court. My name again for the record is Joseph Michaels, attorney registration number 40403. I'm here today on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. This case is not about reversal. This case is about the proper application and analysis of Batson versus Kentucky. It's about deference to the trial court's factual findings. It's about deference to the trial court's credibility determinations. It is about understanding the speed, atmosphere, and nature of voir dire, and that it can be a hectic environment, and that mistakes can and do happen, but that mistakes alone do not necessarily become the province of purposeful racial discrimination. It is about, more than anything else, understanding that Batson and his progeny, and Valdez and Cerrone and his progeny from this court require purposeful discrimination. There are four reasons, at least here, that there was no Batson error that required reversal. The first is that there was no purposeful racial discrimination, either in the record or in the prosecution's articulated reason for the strike. The second is that the prosecution's articulated reason for the strike was not only race neutral, but it was inherent in trial strategy, and not just trial strategy generally, but trial strategy that was rooted in the facts of the case before it. The third reason is that the prosecution articulated a reason that was race neutral. And while the Court of Appeals found that the prosecutor may have in fact referred to a different juror, the fact is that if that happened, the reason was nothing more than a mistake that was still race neutral, and the reason as articulated still encompassed the juror that was struck and still applied in a race-neutral fashion to the juror that was struck. And the fourth reason is that the trial court issued two separate findings crediting the prosecution's reasons, saying that the juror had in fact had a hard time with the identification issue, and credited its own observation, which implicitly credited the prosecution's, that the juror had waffled back and forth and had hesitated a significant amount of time while discussing the identification.
So in this particular case, it went into the third stage of the Batson analysis, and there were factual findings in favor of the prosecution?
The trial court?
Yeah.
Yes, it did go to the third stage, and there were very specific findings of facts, and that can be located on page, I believe it's 164, 165 of the transcripts of 1214.
And then the court concluded on those facts that there was no purposeful racial discrimination?
Correct. The trial court denied the Batson challenge based on those two findings.
Well, can we stay with that point for a moment?
Certainly.
The trial court never actually used those words, though, right? The trial court did not say there was no purposeful discrimination. You're making an inference based on the exchange that occurred. Is that right?
The prosecution never uttered the specific magic words that there was no purposeful racial discrimination. It said that the trial court never did. But it denied the strike after articulating the two reasons that the prosecution had given and buttressing his own observations.
Okay, thank you.
Does that answer your question?
It does for the moment.
For the moment, sir. Most importantly, I think, is that the Court of Appeals explicitly disclaimed any finding of purposeful racial discrimination in making its finding. It said simply that the record didn't support that the prosecution's reasons weren't racially discriminatory, but it explicitly said that the prosecutor didn't act out of racial discrimination or racial animus. And this flies directly counter to the entire progeny of Batson, from Batson to Snyder to Hernandez, to both the Miller L cases, to Rice versus Collins, and to this court's holdings in Valdez and Cerrone. Every U.S. Supreme Court has held that there must be purposeful, in this case, racial discrimination. And without it, the purpose of Batson isn't necessarily implicated.
Counsel, can I stop you right there? Because you used the phrase racial animus and purposeful discrimination. I just want to make sure I understand exactly what you mean by that in this context.
Sure.
Do you understand Batson to require a defendant raising a Batson claim simply to prove that the prosecution's decision was based on race, or are you reading Batson to require more than that? In other words, that the prosecution acted out of animus toward a particular racial group?
More to the latter, Your Honor, and part of that is because the burden is always on the defendant to establish that a Batson violation has occurred, and it's not that they have to establish that the prosecutor disliked the person of race or the person of gender, as Batson also applies to. But that has to be motivated by that race, by the racial reason, by the racial strife. And so in my brief, especially in the reply brief, I talk about animus as a shorthand for proving that it's motivated by an impermissible racial reason.
But an impermissible racial reason is simply that the decision was based on race. Like whether, regardless of whether the prosecution may have harbored the world toward a particular racial group, it's simply that the exercise of the peremptory was based on race.
Certainly.
Okay.
But in Batson, and again, it's surprising, but Batson explicitly held that the invidious quality of governmental action claimed to be racially discriminatory must be tied to a racially discriminatory purpose. So Batson's concern was with dealing with a racially discriminatory reason for issuing the challenge in the first place. But I hope that clarifies.
It does, thank you.
Batson, to follow up on that, Batson is not about challenging a juror every time the prosecutor uses a peremptory challenge simply when a juror is of a certain race or a certain gender. That would eviscerate the entire purpose of Batson and sort of undercut the logical principles behind it. Rather, it has to be motivated because of the juror's race, because of the juror's gender. If the strike simply includes reasons and the opposing counsel stands up and says, Your Honor, Batson, that doesn't satisfy a prima facie case, let alone rise to the level of concern that Batson was focused on. And in essence, that would create something of an appellate parachute where trial counsel would be motivated to issue as many Batson challenges as they could and then hope something worked for them on appeal.
Are you suggesting here that the prima facie case was not made?
No, I think here what it was, okay. I was simply trying to tie in the entire test from step on. And this might be a good opportunity to take a step back and review the test, although I'm certain this court is well aware of it. And that's the person issuing the Batson strike must first make a prima facie case, which, as this court knows, has three subparts. First, you have to identify that the juror is part of a racial minority or a certain race or certain gender, and that there is potentially a history or a possibility of abusing that challenge in the jury selection process, and how the prosecution may have abused it in this. So there is that third prong that I think sometimes gets overlooked, that you have to identify how the challenge is being made in this particular case. It's not just, Your Honor, I have a challenge in the Batson. It goes a little farther than that. The second step, of course, is that the prosecution must be afforded the opportunity to respond with a race-neutral reason. And a long line of cases, this court knows, specifically in Perkett and Leland, talks about how it doesn't have to be necessarily a convincing or a persuasive or plausible reason so long as it's race-neutral. And then during the third step, and there's a little bit of confusion, I think, in this third step, but before the trial court can issue findings of fact on the third step, the defendant in this case the proponent of the Batson strike has to have a chance to rebut, at which point the trial court will make its own factual determinations, which, as this court does, and we'll talk about at some point in this argument, is afforded great deference.
Why don't you go on with the third step? How would you articulate what the court's finding is in the third step?
The court's finding here, and if you'll indulge me, I can just simply read it to you, or I can categorize it.
And I didn't mean this court's finding. What is a court supposed to find in the third step?
Certainly. Ideally, a court is going to look at the reason offered by the, in this case, the prosecution. I'm going to refer to prosecution and defendant instead of moving party and striking party, just for clarity's sake. The trial court will look at the race-neutral reason and say, I find that this race-neutral reason is applicable or not applicable for whatever reason that is inherent in the prosecution. As an explanation, inherent in the defendant's rebuttal and initial prima facie case, and whatever they can recall from jury voir dire, recognizing that voir dire is very fast, and sometimes statements are going to be inartful, a little inaccurate, and maybe not the best articulation or best summary of what a juror said or what the prosecution had said or what the defendant had said at the time to the particular juror.
When you say this reason is applicable, do you mean the court's finding that was the reason for the strike?
Correct. But I don't think the court is limited to that, to the one reason. I think it can go on and discuss all aspects that are relevant, particularly, and this is repeatedly emphasized in every U.S. Supreme Court case and a number of circuit cases and courts from this court and our Court of Appeals, that the demeanor of the prosecution and the credibility of the prosecution is one of the, if not the key element. And it's solely within the province and the peculiar within the trial court's province, I believe is the exact phrase. And the idea is that the trial court's finding of fact encompasses a very specific and very unique role in determining the prosecution's credibility, something that doesn't even remotely read off of a cold record. And we have something like that here, where the court clearly understood what the prosecution was talking about, referenced the juror, and was talking about how this juror was hesitant and waffling and very uncomfortable with the idea. And pauses, intonation, speed, hesitancy, things like that don't translate across a cold record. So all we're left with are what the trial court can put on there. And obviously, the more that the trial court can put on there, the better. But the deference still has to carry through the appellate process. And indeed, there's no other substitute for it, really, besides looking at a cold record and cold responses and trying to guess what the inflection of intonation could suggest. Does that answer your question? Here we have a prosecutor who point blank asked the juror, we have an issue of identity in this case. If our victim can't identify her attacker, would that cause you pause? And the juror said, unambiguously, that would. Now, the prosecutor continued on with the juror saying, well, there are also other ways of establishing identity, DNA, scientific, and use the hypothetical of a burglary and a fingerprint left behind in that burglary. And the juror said, well, yeah, okay, I might be able to take that. But that's certainly a different hypothetical of an anonymous person entering your house while someone's there or maybe not there, not being seen, and leaving fingerprints behind, versus a sexual assault where we had here, where the attacker and the victim are essentially face-to-face. And it would be a very specific reason that a prosecutor would want to have a juror say, I don't think I can accept that, or I do think I can accept that, or root out the people who think, man, I really want to have my witness identification in this case. And that's something that's rooted not only in trial strategy, but in the facts of this specific trial strategy and this specific case. And that's something that when the U.S. Supreme Court has reversed on, they decided that the articulated reasons don't line up with what the prosecutor is trying to argue in terms of the case. Here we have the exact opposite. We have the reasons directly lines up with what the prosecutor is going to have to put on the case, namely identifying a defendant who is not identified by the victim, who can only be identified through through DNA evidence.
Could I go back to your statement about the third step again, in line of the specifics you're talking about here?
Certainly.
Here, the way you explain that, and I think I understand that, that it seems like there is a question because of what the judge ruled, whether he, as a result of his observation of demeanor and whatever, understood the situation to be the same as the prosecutor did. But that's not necessarily the case, is it? I mean, if there really were a situation in which the prosecutor just had his witnesses mixed up or something, whatever it was, and gave a reason that was clearly unsupported by the record, and the judge went ahead and accepted that reason as his reason, even though that, what I'm looking at is, you're asking for a really broad rule, it seems to me, that this has to be, the only basis for granting would be that really one of racial animus. But is there something in between, which would just be simply the judge crediting a neutral reason as to which there was simply no evidence? Would the judge's finding not then nevertheless be clearly erroneous?
I think part of that goes back to the credibility determination, Your Honor. Because first and foremost, what the Batson third step ruling looks at is the credibility and demeanor of, in this case, the prosecutor. And so I have two responses, I think, to your specific question. And one of them I'm going to talk about a little bit more when we talk about the issue of remedy. And the other one is the whole idea of this mistaken identification of juror X when, in fact, they were trying to challenge juror Y. And I would direct this court, and I realize this is a habeas case, but I would direct this court to Rice versus Collins, the U.S. Supreme Court case. And it is cited in my brief on several occasions. And in that case, the prosecutor erroneously identified a juror, and I can't remember the letter of the juror's name as an abbreviation, but the prosecutor identified this juror as being a young single woman when in fact she was an elder grandmother. And the prosecutor identified quite a few race-neutral reasons, and the trial court rejected one of them because it was clearly wrong in light of the U.S. Supreme Court precedent. But it credited the other two, including this one about age. And it went up through the California state system. The California Court of Appeals upheld it, saying that even though the prosecutor misidentified the juror based on race, on age, the strike itself was still race neutral, and the reasons were still race neutral, and the prosecution was still credible. It was clearly not driven by this urge to get rid of the juror because of racial pretext or racial discrimination. And the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately upheld that, saying that an error of that magnitude or a simple error doesn't go anywhere close to the truth-seeking function that Batson was designed to protect, and the constitutional rights that Batson was designed to protect. More likely, and again, as here, it's simply an innocent transposition as a result of the hectic nature and the hectic atmosphere of voir dire.
Wasn't there in Rice, were there multiple bases offered, at least a couple of which were supported by the record?
There were, as I recall, three bases offered, one of which was flat
protected. Yeah, but there were others that were supported by the record.
Right, but Rice, there were two that were supported. One of them was that she was young, and that wasn't supported by the record. And the other one was that she was single and was new to the community, therefore might not have community ties. And there was actually a question, I believe, in Rice about whether that was accurate or not, whether she had just moved there or whether she'd been there for a while. But the discussion in Rice really focused on this issue of age and it being it's essentially an honest mistake is something that's not the ambit of Batson and that, the ambit of reversal.
And so if a single basis is offered and that basis turns out to be directly refuted by the record, in your view, as long as the prosecutor genuinely believed, had a mistaken belief, but a genuine belief, and the trial court accepts that genuine belief, there is no problem with that?
I think, I mean, certainly it's a more problematic situation, but I don't think it automatically requires reversal. And the two, there are two responses to that, because first, the first one is back to the deference we have to give the trial court and the ability for the trial court to understand what's motivating the prosecutor. If it's an innocent mistake, then Batson isn't harmed. Batson isn't even necessarily invoked. The other question is, if there's one single record, if there's one single issue, and the prosecution is wrong on that one single issue, I don't think, and this jumps to the third issue, the remedy is not to outright reverse and start over from scratch. The remedy under those situations is to say, look, there's a real question about what's going on here in the record. We don't know if the prosecution legitimately meant to strike juror X instead of juror Y. We don't know if the trial court understood that he or she, the prosecutor, was talking about juror X instead of juror Y, or if the trial court was understanding that they were talking about juror Y.
And recognizing all of that, I mean, I guess that brings me back to your original statement that step three of the analysis was in fact conducted here, because it seems as though the defense brought to the court's attention that at least the defense counsel believed this was contrary to what that juror had said, but never really got a chance to fully articulate that and sort of hash out whether there was in fact a mistake. So can we really say on this record that step three was fully satisfied?
I certainly think that is an option for this court to remand under, to do a full analysis of step three. And there are certain court of appeals cases, and they're cited, I believe, Portley and Mendoza are the two off the top of my head that I can think of, where the court fails to conduct a full analysis of step three, and so they remanded even though step three had already been somewhat underway at that point. And there are a couple of circuit cases as well. The McAllister case from the Sixth Circuit is one of them. I think it's probably a close question. I certainly think that the prosecutor's statement and reason for challenging the juror specifically encompassed the whole idea of juror E's hesitance with the absence of identification by the victim. And so I do think that the prosecution discussed the correct juror, even if the prosecution's shorthand for DNA evidence and scientific evidence could also encompass several other jurors. But I think the big question is, and the correct result is, when in doubt, reversal is not the option. Reversal is not is not required if there's a question about what the outcome should be, and that's what a remand should do. And that's why I think the Court of Appeals in this case was too quick to discount the deference due to the trial court, the race-neutral reasons given, and the fact that the record simply didn't suggest that it was motivated by racial discrimination or by any racial reasons, one way or another. So I think it was too quick to go to the, all right, we decided this error, so let's decide that it's structural error and reverse automatically, instead of suggesting, here's what the trial court can look for on a remand. And I think that, in this case, is the more appropriate response. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
May I quickly follow up? I know you're probably trying to save some time for rebuttal. While we're on this issue of remand, let me just invite your thoughts about what that remand hearing would look like. Would the trial court be able to look at the transcript of the voir dire and perhaps do some kind of comparative juror analysis? You seem to suggest that Snyder militates against that, and so I'd like you to speak to that issue about what the trial court is able to look at. And then there's also the question of, well, does the prosecutor get to come back and supplement the record in any fashion about what her motivation was? If she was conflating jurors, does she get to try and disentangle that, or is she stuck with what she said at the time?
Certainly. Well, the trial court is certainly going to start with the transcript that we have, because that's the cold hard statements of what's been going on. I think there does have to be a discussion with the prosecution, with the prosecutor, to figure out, is that what you meant? Is that what you didn't mean? Which juror were we talking about? And obviously, the prosecutor is going to have to use the cold transcript to jog her memory in this case. I think it does come back down to a full step three factual determination of credibility, of demeanor, of reasons behind the strike. I don't think it starts and ends with the transcript, and I don't think it can, for the same reasons that that we talk about all the deference to the trial court's determinations throughout the appellate process. In terms of comparative juror analysis, that's a little bit trickier because Snyder very clearly says that an analysis of a cold transcript can lead to erroneous or misleading results as a result of misunderstanding or not having that discourse at the time. I think in purposes of being of having a reason to be as comprehensive as possible, then yes, you need to allow the prosecution and potentially the defense counsel to discuss other jurors if that in fact is an issue. I don't think it is one here because I think the more you start talking about other jurors, the more you're injecting larger and larger tangents into what can be a very specific discussion. And trial courts have been doing these Batson remands for years. There are a number of court of appeals cases, and this court's case in Craig versus Carlson talks about the appropriate procedure being a remand. And there are a number of cases cited in these reply briefs, both this one and in the next case, that talk about the propriety of a remand whenever there's a factual question, essentially. I think it would be open, and I think it certainly would be allowable to supplement the record with additional discussion about what the prosecution's intentions were. Because I think that's the idea is that we want to arrive at the truth and have a truth-seeking function. And that's what the whole remand would be designed to arrive at. I want to, if there are no further questions on either of that, I want to talk very briefly about the structural error issue and then maybe save 2 minutes for rebuttal, apparently. To reverse automatically every time that we get to step three and say that trial court's findings don't necessarily square with the record, automatically requires appellate courts or this court to essentially give a greater weight to a cold appellate record than to the trial court's determination. The U.S. Court of Appeals in the Sixth District in United States versus Wolford made that very distinct finding and wanted to say, you have to go to the trial court, you have to go to those rulings, and you have to go to the remand if at all possible. Structural error, as this court knows, are the exceptions, they're not the rule. It's a very, very narrow category of error. Trial errors occur during the presentation of the case to the jury. This is all by way of background. I know this court is well versed in structural error.
Well, I just want to go over that. What's left of structural error these days?
What's left of structural error these days?
Following recent decision.
Well, I'll actually refer you back to this court's own recent case in Hagos, where you identified a very specific distinction between structural error, constitutional harmless error, non-constitutional harmless error, et cetera, et cetera. What's left of it is the being tried before an impartial judge, being tried without counsel, something that goes from the entire trial process. Vasquez versus Hillary, I know we'll talk about that a little bit more over the course of this morning, talks about racial discrimination in the selection of grand juries. It's comparable, but I don't know that it's necessarily on point, because it talks about grand juries, which starts well before the actual trial process occurs, and it was concerned not so much with the litigants picking the juries, the prosecution and defense, but the trial court using racially discriminatory methods to pick the jury. And so Vasquez imposed structural error on the grand jury selection process because it affected the way the entire indictment was framed. And it talked about essentially requiring the trial courts to police themselves instead of being a racist old club that would cast aspersions on the judiciary, which is something that usually becomes one of the bigger errors, a big consideration during structural error. I think it's very relevant to note, and I'm going to finish with this unless there's a question and save the rest of my time for rebuttal, but it's very relevant to note that no U.S. Supreme Court has ever called Batson a structural error, despite many opportunities to have done so since Batson was handed down. That includes Fulminante, that includes Nader, that includes this court in Hagos and Kretzinger. No court has called it, no U.S. Supreme Court or this court has not called it structural error. Now, if there is an actual substantive Batson error, where in the strike is issued with racial motivation, racial discrimination, and it clearly offends Batson, then yes, I think the remedy is probably reversal in that case. But that is a very, very narrow subset of cases. And to call every Batson error as step three structural error, I think would confuse trial courts more than it would help them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Blanchard. Again, Carolyn Blanchard for Mr. Wilson. Would you mind moving the microphone to your, yeah, thank you.
Okay, this case is about the judge making a decision on the wrong facts. And Mr. Romney's decision was of constitutional dimension because it excluded a juror of African American descent from the jury panel because of his race. My client, Mr. Wilson, is an African-American man. Mr. Wilson and the juror, the excused juror's right to equal protection if the law was violated by this decision, because it was a decision based on race. The Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment guarantees my client the right to have a jury selected on a non-discriminatory basis. This court should affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals, remand for a new trial based on structural error, because there was purposeful racial discrimination against the jury. And the Court of Appeals decision twice says at page 9 and 11 of the slip opinion that their decision is based on purposeful racial discrimination, because the prosecutor in this case, when she espoused her race neutral reasons for excusing the juror, both of these reasons were not factually based. The purposeful racial discrimination in this case, the Batson objection, was brought to the attention of the trial judge after the prosecutor excused one African American juror from the original 12 or whatever number, original people in the box. And that was actually her only peremptory challenge that she issued in this case. The prosecutor acted with a discriminatory purpose because the race-neutral reasons she gave in support of her challenge were not supported by the record. That is, the reasons she gave, Juror E did not say what she said he said. Her first reason, race-neutral reason she gave, was he was very uncomfortable with eyewitness, black eyewitness identification. But what was the question? Her question was, would it give you pause if the complainant couldn't identify her assailant? Well, jury answered, well, sure, which is a reasonable answer. The complainant can't identify her attacker. Where's the identification? But then the prosecutor asked two more questions about this identification and said essentially, well, my witness can't identify her assailant, but we can show you in other ways. Will you be able to find it? And jury said yes.
Well, while we're on the part about the record and whether the record's wrong, just with regard to this case, are we interested, from your point of view, are we interested in reviewing this, whether the prosecutor got the record right or whether the prosecutor understood what happened in the way in which he reported it to the judge? And I guess I mean by that, let's take this exact case. If the witness, even though he said, yes, I would believe DNA evidence, did it in such a hesitating and qualified way that the prosecutor understood it to mean he's going to be critical of DNA evidence, which would be the important thing for purposes of our review?
Well, you have the record to review, and the prosecutor never gave him a motive reason for excusing this juror. She gave factual reasons. She said he was uncomfortable with the lack of eyewitness identification. Now, uncomfortable to me is an intellectual uncomfortable with lack of identification. So I guess the question is, what did this prosecutor mean by uncomfortable? But I don't think that that was an emotive reason. She didn't say, oh, he hesitated, which the judge found that he did, although the prosecutor never stated that.
Let me say it just a slightly different way. It seems that in much of the case law, we're concerned here with both U.S. and ours, with whether the reasons were pretextual. Does that not imply that the prosecutor is falsely giving reasons in order to get around a real reason? And therefore, if the prosecutor understood the witness to have responded the way she indicates, then her reason wouldn't be pretextual, would it? And would that be okay then for the judge to find that it was not a pretextual reason?
Okay, okay, I'm glad.
You're saying that if the judge believed, the prosecutor believed, what she said about the jury, then we should accept that as fact?
I guess what I'm doing is asking you.
Okay, so that's your question. All right. No, I think the judge has to use his own reason and base his reason on facts.
Okay, right there, maybe that's getting to the point. And what is the judge to determine? Is the judge to determine whether the prosecutor is right about the record and that was her reason at the time, or is he to determine whether the reason she gives is pretextual?
Well, the judge has to determine if what the prosecutor said actually was said. Did it happen? And if the judge says, well, no, she didn't say it, the jury didn't say that, then that's pretextual. That's the way I would interpret it.
Oh, okay, so pretextual in your mind doesn't mean that it's a deliberate attempt to get around the real reason, but it's a false reason that's being offered on purpose. Pretextual just means it's wrong. Is that in your mind what pretextual means?
I think it can mean both, and I think you know that too. I think it can mean both. I mean, it's usually using case law as a way of saying, not saying why. I think what the case law looks at is, was the judge's reason based on fact? Was the reasoning there in the record? I don't think all the cases talk about it. Counsel's demeanor, what was the demeanor of the proponent of the challenge? I think that's true, but all these cases that I read in preparing here, they all rely that there's at least one factual misstatement in the record. There's one prosecutor made one actual fact that was supported by the record in her challenge.
So may I just join this conversation a little bit, please?
Sure.
So I guess my question is this. So what if the prosecutor says, you know, comes back and the accusation is that this is based upon some sort of racial animus, and he or she says, no, it's not. Juror F said all of these things, and that's the reason that I'm wanting to excuse Juror F. But it turns out that what Juror F said wasn't true. That's not exactly what happened. Those things weren't said by Juror F. Well, the judge has to get involved then and said, oh, wait a second, that's not what happened here, right?
Right.
And so that's not a good reason to combat this suggestion of racial animus, right?
That's not.
You can't make up things to that make up what the juror said when you're trying to combat the suggestion that you're
correct.
Improperly. Yeah. So you agree with me on that. Here, in essence, the prosecutor said things that weren't true, right?
That's my argument.
Sure, but it seems that it's a more complex situation because what he or she said might have been true about somebody else, right?
Correct.
So now we're in this real dilemma because what's the poor judge supposed to do? I mean, he's supposed to straighten this all out on the record, right? Somehow I'm saying, wait a second, that wasn't said by F, might have been said by G. Is that what you're arguing?
My argument is the judge has got to determine what was actually said.
Sure, but the judge shouldn't do that. Instead he said, well, okay, that seems satisfactory, so I'm not going to grant the Batson challenge. Now we get to the appellate court, and the appellate court says, no, wait a second. A good judge would have looked at the record and said, that wasn't said.
Right? I agree with that.
So your argument is that if they get it wrong, if the lawyer miscites what happened in the courtroom, that's exactly the same as racial animus. You're equating getting it wrong with having a racial motive, aren't you?
Well, I don't think animus is part of his argument.
Well, let's say the whole reason Batson exists is because we're trying to correct the problem that sometimes people want to excuse jurors for improper purposes.
Correct.
Racial animus. But here, it's pretty clear that there wasn't an improper purpose. It's just pretty clear also that everybody seemed to be getting it wrong. Factually, right?
Well, to put it bluntly, why did they pick on the black man then? Why did they put it on the black man?
But that's kind of what we're left with is, if we're trying to really sort this out, drill down, as they say, we kind of get into this problem because can we necessarily assume that getting wrong is the same as having racial animus? Is a mistake of fact the same as discriminatory intent?
Good question. I think the problem with this discrimination that occurred here is that, well, in this situation, the Batson discussion was held at the bench. No one heard about what was actually said. If it had all been said in open court and people were sitting in the courtroom and heard this discussion that, well, this man supposedly said this, but he didn't say that, and everybody could see that this was kind of wrong, that it would appear as if this man was being excused because of his race. I mean, what that would be the general conclusion, I believe, of the audience. And this is one of the reasons why we have Batson, because racial discrimination hurts the whole community. And we don't want that to be happening in our country. And why this discussion was held at the bench, I don't know, but there it was, and so it was silent in this situation.
I actually used to hold all of these kinds of conversations at the bench as well. And my reasoning was that people would speak more openly at the bench when they couldn't be heard. And I could actually ask questions and kind of get to the point that people were trying to make at the bench.
Well, but I believe that's one of the reasons for Batson, is that we don't want to make it look like we're discriminating as well.
So, and this will be my last question, I promise. So do you think what happened here is that it looked like there was discrimination, or was there really discrimination?
Well, I think it looked like there was discrimination, and I think...
But there probably wasn't really discrimination?
Well, those last few supplemental things I sent in, these psychologists say that people transfer bad things onto the African Americans, or, you know, this, we have these sociological reasons for how we...
Sure, and the concept of...
...this information that's coming into.
Sure, the concept of implicit bias, I think, is what those... But we don't have a record that would support that in any way, do we?
Implicit bias?
Uh-huh. That sort of transference that you don't really know that you're going to be discriminatory.
Well, I think we do, and that the things said by the other jurors were, to me, appeared much more questioning of DNA than well, jury have said he believed in DNA. He never hesitated about believing in DNA, but two or three of the other jurors did, and they were not excused.
Okay, I understand your position. Thank you.
Can I take a crack? As I understand this, prosecution offers a basis for striking this juror, and that juror, it turns out that juror did not say what the prosecution said the juror said, right? So that's refuted by the record. Is it possible in your mind that the prosecutor could make a mistake? Or is it just the mere fact that there's been an inaccuracy or perhaps a misrecollection that in and of itself, all standing alone, is evidence of discrimination? Or is the third choice, we just don't know, without exploring a little further?
Well, I believe everybody can make a mistake, of course.
Okay.
But we have lots of mistakes in trials. Lots of defense attorneys make the wrong objection, and we never get a second chance to correct that wrong objection. And the attorney may have wanted to make the right objection, he just chose the wrong words. But still, they get punished for that, for not making the correct words come out of the
right. So the sequence here that I'd like to explore is prosecution makes the proper reason. Defense counsel says, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's what that juror said. And before they can get sort of sorted out, hey, was that a mistake? Is that what you really meant? The whole analysis kind of gets cut off. So we're sort of left not really sure. Given this discrepancy, is that discrepancy indicative of an honest mistake? Or is that discrepancy indicative of something more, you know, a race-based decision? And I guess, well, my question is leading is, shouldn't we just send this back and let it all get sorted out?
Well, I don't think there should be a second chance on this. I don't think that's the traditional method of solving these kind of problems, is getting a second chance.
But you concede, though, that it's possible that this discrepancy could be indicative of an honest mistake.
I don't think so. I don't think this was an honest mistake in this case. I think this prosecutor truly believed the African-American man said what she said he said.
Well, isn't that the problem with the Court of Appeals analysis? We really need to give the trial judge the latitude of having been in the courtroom and observed what was going on.
I'm sorry,
Isn't that the fundamental problem with the Court of Appeals analysis? That it can't sit there as a trial judge and discern what actually went on. So isn't it true that our cases say that the relief that's available at the appellate level is to send it back to the trial judge?
Well, send it back to the trial judge if there hasn't been a complete ruling. Usually there's not a complete ruling. The judge made three finding of facts in this case.
And two of them he made up himself, which the judge is supposed to respond to what the prosecutor says, not make up his own reasons for a race-neutral reason for excusing the juror. And the one reason, his third reason, well, that was the emotive one, but he said this juror, he didn't recall what this juror said about this burglary scenario, that he said all the jurors were asked about. But the only juror that was asked about that scenario was juror E. I questioned the judge if he didn't recall what juror E said. But the judge made a ruling. The ruling was complete. We have all three stages of the Batson steps. The ruling was complete, but it was inaccurate. It was based on the wrong facts.
Ms. Blanchard, good morning. Can I follow up? You said he made up two of the reasons. Can you just identify what two reasons you believe the trial judge made up?
Well, waffled back and forth. There was no waffling back and forth on the DNA evidence. The jury always said he believed in DNA and scientific evidence. And the second one was he hesitated for an extended period.
How can we tell that from the record?
Well, the prosecutor never argued that. That's why I'm saying the judge supplied the race-neutral reason. Because the prosecutor never mentioned anything about the jury hesitating for an extended period. It's not the judge's job to supply a race-neutral reason.
But wasn't the prosecutor talking about this hesitancy with regard to identification? And the court basically said, yeah, he hesitated for an extended period of time.
The word the prosecutor used was uncomfortable with the lack of eyewitness identification.
So is it your position then that the prosecutor should have grounded in exactly how the juror said it as compared to what his impression was of what the juror said?
I think the only way to address the issue is say there's emotive reasons that he made a face or she... He hesitated. I mean, the prosecutor never said hesitated. The prosecutor said uncomfortable. Uncomfortable can have a lot of meanings, but I think in this situation, it's uncomfortable with a lack of eyewitness identification, which is an intellectual thing, a mind thing, a thought, not an emotion.
Right, but we always have to figure out what someone's thinking through circumstantial evidence, how they say something. A voice inflection, a hesitation. And the problem is that doesn't come through in the record, right? The record doesn't say juror paused for a really long time.
That's so correct.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is how do we find that the trial court abused its discretion in making that finding?
Because from the tenor of the prosecution's argument, she didn't say anything about hesitation or an emotive reason.
She used the word uncomfortable, not hesitation. So those two have to match up.
Well, not the precise words, but if she said, oh, he kind of waggled his head, or he kind of looked up in the sky, and that gave me the impression that he was really uncomfortable with eyelids or identification. The case law says if a prosecutor can't make this kind of objection, they're not very up on their game. And that's, this is, to my knowledge, an experienced prosecutor who should be able to make an adequate Batson or a non-protectional argument.
But would you agree that a lawyer, either side, saying this witness was uncomfortable with this concept is a non-race reason, that would be acceptable, correct? it really comes down to the court making credibility determination of whether they believe that lawyer's statement about that, correct?
That's how the case law, yes. Framed, yes.
Thank you, I think it was Justice Hood. Ms. Blanchard, over here. Let's
talk a little bit about step three. I want to sort of pull back out to more of a macro level. We're talking about the nuances of things that unfolded very quickly in real time. But let's step back and look at the bigger picture. Isn't step three really about whether there's a determination by the trial court that there's purposeful discrimination?
Correct.
Right. And so, as we discussed earlier, that sometimes that term is used synonymously with racial animus, right?
I didn't see that much in the case of cases that I read about racial animus, but discrimination.
Well, here's where I'm going with it. Maybe you understand. Neither the trial court nor the court of appeals found purposeful discrimination or racial animus. In fact, the court of appeals, in its footnote 4, explicitly says that it's not finding racial animus. So how should we feel about embracing a rule that would allow for dead bang reversible error where there is no finding by either the trial court or the court of appeals that it was racially motivated?
Well, my reading of the court of appeals, I find it twice they said that. On page 9 of the slip opinion and on page 11 of the slip opinion, the court of appeals says what they view in the record shows racial animus. Purposeful racial discrimination. And in page 11, they find that the pretextual nature of the prosecutor's reasons was based on race.
But the Court of Appeals is doing it based on a presumption that it's finding, right? It's presuming if there is a factual mistake in providing the race-neutral explanation that is necessarily pretextual and evidence of racial discrimination. And that's the way that it gets to its step. That's the way it gets to purposeful discrimination here. It never actually finds that it's racially motivated, right?
It never actually finds.
I understand what you just said, but does the Court of Appeals ultimately ever really find any racial motivation in what the prosecutor did here?
Yes, because none of the reasons she gave for excusing this juror were based on facts in the record. That's what they said.
All right, thank you.
Well, I think I have nothing more to say, and I request you affirm the court of appeals.
All right, thank you very much. I think you have about a minute, Mr. Michaels.
I think the big distinction that we need to make here is there's a significant difference between mistake and pretext. Pretext, by definition, means that there is an ulterior motive. In this case, as Justice Boreth, you were suggesting, the Court of Appeals had to find a racially motivated pretext. But the Court of Appeals didn't find that. It simply found the record disagreed with what the prosecution's reasons were. And that suggests the possibility of mistake. Now, if we look at the prosecution's reasons as articulated to the trial court, it's very clear that the prosecution is identifying reasons that are relevant to her voir dire with jury, as well as with voir dire generally, and the idea of witness identification. To be mistaken means that there is no racial animus or no pretext. With regard to your question, Justice Boreth, the idea of a trial court is that it has to make factual findings. It's not Chief Justice Rice, I've seen him out of time.
Yes, you are. Would you like him to answer that question?
Yeah, if you could just finish that, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you. The idea is that under Step 3, a trial court is required to make factual findings. I think this concept of a clinical definition of uncomfortable or discomfort, meaning only one thing, is to look at a script on a cold review of a record and not understand the colloquial use that people can use in the inartful way that perhaps things can get expressed. The trial court's job is to make factual findings in support of its ultimate determination. And that's what we have here. It was able to use the prosecution's explanation and its own observations. Thank you all for your time. I would ask that you reverse the court.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your argument, Mr. Michelson. Also, we appreciate yours, Ms. Blanchard. Thank you both.